You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Chris Hedges has been called one of the great moral voices of our times, and as one reviewer put it, he shakes his finger at everybody. He's written scathing criticisms of both the Democratic and Republican parties and their ties to big corporations, the healthcare industry, and the way they conduct foreign policy. And one of his biggest targets has been the passivity of American media. He was a journalist for the New York Times for 15 years before being reprimanded for his public comments on the war in Iraq. Shortly thereafter, he decided to leave the paper. The essays in his latest book, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress, originally appeared on the news website Truthdig, where he's a columnist. Now they've been published by Nation Books. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Chris.
Thanks, Leonard.
When you write about the deadly disease of American journalism, what are you referring to? Anyone in particular or anything in particular?
Well, I have a very conflicted relationship with the New York Times, which, an institution I still admire. And yet I think that it has shown, particularly in the last decade, some tremendous moral failings, most of which your listeners know, the abysmal failure to cover in an adequate way the lead-up to the war in Iraq, the utter failure to predict or highlight the financial meltdown in 2008, because they cared more about access than they did about real journalism. But when looks at the broad media landscape, especially on the commercial electronic media, I would say that journalism is completely dead. The commercial networks care about ratings, they care about advertising dollars, they care about news only insofar as it is a vehicle for entertainment and how they make their viewers feel. So bastions like the New York Times, like some of the struggling metropolitan papers, Philadelphia Inquirer, are important because they still keep alive real journalism while other outlets and primarily commercial electronic outlets have walked away from it.
Does the media consumer bear any of the responsibility for this current situation? I mean, if we're talking about ratings and the like and only doing certain kinds of journalism, aren't we? Isn't that because the readers and the viewers want that sort of stuff?
Well, it attracts, a larger or wider audience. Whether educated consumers of news and journalism want that kind of stuff is another question. The problem is that we have undergone a technological revolution, and the monopoly that newspapers once had, connecting sellers with buyers, is gone. That monopoly made newspaper publishers at one point extremely wealthy. The Chanslers, the Sulzbergers, all of that is diminishing. And the internet has created mechanisms by which sellers can reach buyers without using journalistic or news vehicles at all. And that's become very dangerous because with the withering of newsrooms and the destruction of that monopoly, it has made it almost impossible within the culture, the wider culture, to sustain the practice of journalism itself, complete with all of the flaws, many of which I point out, that it has always had.
A journalist told me a story of when he was starting, and he was at some city council meeting, and he saw some exchange between two council members, and he knew something was up. And only somebody who was totally familiar with the terrain could have spotted it, and it led to an important story. And he said, that's dead now, because all local newspapers have eliminated those reporters. If they have survived, they're pretty much just relying on AP and some of the other news syndicates.
Well, that's exactly right. Reporting is slow, laborious, time-consuming, expensive over the long run, and that is vanishing, along with, I think, all of the professions within the society that are grouped around these abstract things like truth and beauty, these capacities of transformation.
But others would argue that the internet has led to the democratization of news, and that citizens are taking on the role of those veteran reporters.
I would argue that that is not the case. What the internet has done is destroyed the, and the Huffington Post, I think, is one of the most guilty offenders, destroyed the capacity of people to make a living. Look, journalists, even at the New York Times, are not highly paid people. They do it and they work very hard and they're very professional because they care, ultimately. They care about the reader. They care if they're good. They care not just about news, but they care about truth. And on the internet, people retreat into intellectual ghettos. There's very, very little reporting. These sites like Huffington Post aggregate, which means they steal information. Bill Keller at the New York Times and others have made this point publicly, and they're right. And the fact is, most people on the internet, while they can write sometimes insightful commentary, rarely even pick up a phone.
Do you think of yourself as a journalist still?
Yes, a journalist who comes perhaps out of an older tradition, the muckrakers, George Orwell, of course, being perhaps my guiding light, a journalist who takes very clear stands and is very public about where he stands, and that is on the side of people who are not only outside the power structure but often abused by the power structure.
Ooh. When you look back at your work with the New York Times, did you not do the same sort of reporting and writing that you criticize the mainstream media for today, this balanced, formulaic approach?
Yes and no. There were certainly moments when I had to write lead alls or major news stories where it was this tit-for-tat kind of journalism.
Which you're very critical of.
Yes, but I'm not the only one. Russell Baker, I mean, all sorts of people are critical of it. Russell Baker wrote a great column a few years ago in the New York Review of Books and said, you know, we need to take away health care coverage for all journalists and then let them go out and cover the health care system. And, of course, he's right. I consciously put myself in reporting situations, Sarajevo, Latin America, the war in El Salvador, the Middle East. I spent a lot of time in Gaza, where all of the reporting I did was out of communities that were being usually persecuted and would not have had a voice without my presence. When I came back to the United States, I told the New York Times my one non-negotiable demand is that I won't go to Washington. That is where you do lunch. That is where you cultivate sources within the power elite and depend on those sources for your journalism. And good foreign correspondents are often in conflict, not only in Washington, and this is both with Republicans and Democrats, but also with their own Washington bureaus, who have a vested interest in promoting the version of reality that is peddled out of Washington.
But how is that any different than when you were in war zones and you depended on the military for information? And I'm sure you reported some of that. You may have not always believed what they were telling you, but or if you were in a foreign capital and you go to the foreign minister or whatever to get information, is it all that different than what happens in Washington?
Yeah, because I didn't do that kind of stuff. For instance, in the first Gulf War, I very rarely interviewed anybody. I was with the Marine Corps, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, above the rank of a Lance Corporal. I purposely, like Ernie Pyle and others, put myself out on the front lines. Now, there were reporters back in Dahran or Riyadh doing the press conferences, and that is a part of journalism. I'm not in any way saying that it is not, but it's not something that I did, and I chose not to do it on purpose.
You make a distinction between truth and fact. How are they different?
They're very different. And I think the great reporters, Cy Hirsch and throughout our history, care more about truth than they care about, let's call it, news. Stories can be balanced. They can be neutral. They can be objective. They can be fair according to the criteria of American journalism and yet not be true.
But the whole idea of a balanced report is that you leave the news consumers to weigh both opinions and arrive at their own conclusions.
Right, but there are, when you walk in, let's say, a village in Kosovo, as I have done, where the Serbs have come in and Serb paramilitary forces have come in and killed large numbers of people, we could, every other paragraph, give the Serbian version of events, but and leave the reader to sort of believe whatever they want to believe.
But we don't do that. We didn't do that during
the
that war.
No, but we did do that after the 22. Well, the New York Times did do that after the bombing, the 22-day bombing of Gaza, where there was a story, and I'm not picking on Ethan Bronner, he's a great reporter and a friend, but he went in and every other paragraph was handed over to a spokesperson from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, who wasn't there. And I think that, you know, great reporting is not about going to official sources of information, but doing that hard work of getting out to where events happened. And that is the power of American journalism, whether you're left or right. And I think even Noam Chomsky, who's very critical of the press, finally would concede that when an American reporter goes to an event and writes about that event from the ground, you can usually trust what they say. And I think that is the strength of American journalism.
My guest is Chris Hedges. His book, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. It is published by Nation Books in the Truth Dig imprint. Well, it seems to me that mainstream media outlets, at least recently, are covering more of the complicated issues, the economy, the housing crisis, unemployment, and they've been painting a pretty grim picture. Have they been doing a better job recently?
Well, they've been responding to reality. Unfortunately, we have seen the build up of huge, quote-unquote, media empires like Fox News that are non-reality based. And I think that when we look at the war now within the journalistic establishment, and let's remember the Christian right has a powerful network, which is often hermetically sealed from most of us because we don't watch it, but news and television that distort reality through the prism or lens of this magical thinking. And that's the battle. You know, I did a book on the Christian right, and I remember being in a room, a creationist seminar in Missouri. In the middle of the lecture, this guy goes off on the New York Times. I'm sure I was the only New York Times reader in the room. But what I realized at that point that, for of course, liberal bias. It's not liberal bias that they hate. It's that it's reality based. It's based on verifiable fact. And the failings of traditional news establishments, commercial news establishments, is not so much lies, although they did disseminate the lies of the Bush administration in the build-up to the war in Iraq, but it's the lie of omission. It's what they don't say, what they don't tell you.
What you mentioned, Fox News. Whenever Fox News is brought up in most articles, it's always contrasted with MSNBC. Do you see that as being fair and balanced?
I think MSNBC, along with Fox News, are both disseminators of journalistic trash. They function as sort of courtiers, as court gossips. They revolve around the same narratives. It's what Sarah Palin said today or Michelle Bachmann.
So either you approve or disapprove.
Right. And so you're gossiping about an agenda that is politically harmless and frankly irrelevant because the personal narratives of particular candidates we're watching, unfortunately, and now have nothing to do with the actual operational structure of the corporate state.
But haven't we heard similar criticisms throughout the history of journalism?
Well, I think that we have to cast a wider net.
Well, has it ever done well in your estimation? Because we were told in the early days of American newspapers they were really opinion sheets. And then we go through a period where a lot is overlooked. If something's embarrassing to JFK, for example, it just doesn't make it into the newspapers. And then we went through the period where everybody complained that anything you did made it into the newspapers. But in the end, journalism has never really been seen as doing its job well.
Well, I think that if you look back before these large monopolies within the news industry, or even if you look back on the alternative press in the 1960s, magazines like Ramparts. Ramparts served a very – but never made a dime, of course. And Robert Scheer, who was the editor, now runs the website I work for in L.A.
And the other major figure has become a very conservative commentator.
Yes, he has. But, you know, they broke all sorts of stories that I think shamed the traditional press into reporting. And when the Pentagon Papers came out – and this is very similar to WikiLeaks there was a decision, are we going to give it to the New York Times, the Washington Post, or should we just give it to Ramparts, which we know will run it? And I think that the power of the alternative press has been to prod the traditional press into doing their job. And with the destruction of the alternative press and the corporatization of the press itself, you have roughly six corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, that control now most media outlets, there has been a tremendous withering of the quality of journalism because there hasn't been this outside pressure to keep it honest.
Chris Hedges is the author of the bestsellers War is a force that gives us meaning. American fascists, also death of the, I'm sorry, it's suddenly of the liberal class, empire of illusion. He is a fellow at the Nation Institute and a columnist at Truthdig, and his latest book is The World as It Is, Dispatches from the Myth of Human Progress, published by Nation Books. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Chris Hedges, whose latest book is The World as It Is, Dispatches from the Myth of Human Progress. It's published by Nation Books in the Truthdig imprint, and that's because Mr. Hedges is a reporter for Truthdig these days. I'm thinking about your title in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. President Obama declared in 2009, "I face the world as it is and cannot stand idle in the face of threats to the American people. For make no mistake, evil does exist in the world." And that phrase, "I face the world as it is," also appears in the president's new national strategy for counterterrorism. I'm assuming that that was an important reason for you to use it as your title.
Wow, it wasn't. But I think the title came out, or the title was taken from a column that was, I think, written before both of those events. I'm very critical, as you know, within the book of Obama and the Democratic Party. But just touching on that Nobel acceptance speech, as a former seminarian, it was an utter perversion of the just war theory. And I found that speech extremely difficult. Very unpalatable.
A former seminarian, before you decided to go into journalism,
yes.
You considered going into the ministry?
Yes. I graduated from seminary but was not ordained.
Now, do you see, obviously there's some kind of link there in your mind.
Yeah, because
a minister is somebody who wants to go out and do well, make the world a better place?
And I think also good preachers care about the truth. Again, getting back to what I think good journalists and reporters care about. And those reporters who remain fast to it very quickly become management problems within the newsroom. But they, I think, are the most important figures. I mean, those people who climb within these institutions, like all corporate institutions, are primarily careerists, people who are willing to compromise on moral issues that great reporters and the Times has them will not.
So were you seen as something of a disruptive force, a pain in the butt at the Times?
Yeah, I think that, I had a very peculiar profession in that I was a war correspondent. When you think about it, war correspondents are paid and rewarded for defying not only authority, but authority figures that are trying to kill them. And that makes figures like it myself renegades virtually when they come back within the newsroom because the qualities that make them a good war reporter don't fit in a corporate environment.
Many people who on the right criticize the media in general as being liberal, and people in the media argue that that's not really the case or that they can rise above their political viewpoints. You don't even bother with that. You just say that liberals are useless.
Well, the liberal class in this country has morphed into neoliberalism, I don't know what you want to call it. They embrace preemptive war. They refuse to challenge the malfeasance and criminal activity of Wall Street. They have walked away from the most basic tenets of the New Deal. And self-identified liberals, Bill Clinton would be the poster child for this, have turned their back on the working class, indeed carried out policies such as NAFTA, the destruction of welfare, that has thrust a knife into the back of the working class.
And why do you think the Democratic Party has changed so much? I was thinking recently of the Republican Party and Dwight D. Eisenhower, who today probably, whose position today probably would be somewhere near the right of the Democratic Party.
Money. Clinton understood that if he served corporate interests, he would get corporate money, so that by the 90s, the Democrats had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and by the time Obama ran for president in 2008, they got more.
And you're calling for real activism in America, including civil disobedience, I guess, in the Gandhian, Martin Luther King kind of civil disobedience. But most of the activism we've been seeing these days has been on the right. Tea Party. Why do you think there hasn't been more discontent on the left, considering the fact that there are an awful lot of people who are unemployed and who have real problems just getting by?
Well, first of all, because there is no left. The radical movements in this country, the Wobblies, the old CIO, were all destroyed. The publications, Appeal to Reason, masses were all wiped out. And then there was a disemboweling of the liberal class itself with the Red Scare and the witch hunts. Thousands of university professors lose their jobs in the 50s. So the radical left is destroyed, these populist movements.
But it didn't have a resurgence in the 60s, in the anti-Vietnam war period?
I would argue that by the 1960s, the new left bore little resemblance to the old left of the early 19th century, which was allied with labor. You had labor unions, Lane Kirkland, George Meany, that were denouncing not only the hippies out in the street, but supporting Nixon's war in Indochina, and I think there was a kind of narcissist. I come out of the religious left, by the way. My father was an activist, but we were followers of the Berrigans, and I just had lunch with Dan Berrigan, who's just turned 90, lives in New York, and Dorothy Day, and we detested. I was a young child, but I mean, the religious left detested the hedonism and self-indulgence and narcissism of the new left movement, and a lot of people don't understand that break. And I think that severing itself from the working class, this was a middle class phenomena, and it created class divides. So, and it was built primarily around a hatred of Nixon and the Vietnam War. Once the war ended and when Nixon was gone, the new left evaporated.
There are people who would argue that the Democratic Party seriously damaged itself by allying itself with the poor, with racial minorities. And we saw in more recent years a resurgence when the Democratic Party started using the word middle class all the time.
Well, I think that the phenomena of the Tea Party and the rise of the lunatic fringe within the Republican Party is a direct result of the Democrats becoming completely tone deaf to the suffering of working men and women in this country.
You have to be careful when you call them the lunatic fringe. Joe Nocera in the New York Times had to apologize for calling people in the Tea Party terrorists.
Well, I didn't call them terrorists, but they are lunatics.
Chris Hedges' book is called The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. It's published by Nation Books in the Truth Dig imprint. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You also criticize the liberal and progressive intelligentsia. Do you believe that it has become too far removed from reality?
Yeah, I think the part of the, you ask why there's no sort of response on the left, and that is because liberal or self-identified liberals continue to speak in the dead language of policies and issues without recognizing that tens of millions of this people in America are not only enraged but have a legitimate right to be enraged. They have been betrayed.
You mentioned that you have been critical of President Obama. In fact, you refer to him as Brand Obama.
Well, that's how he functioned. He functioned the same way that a few years ago Bennington and Calvin Klein used to put up these big billboards with people of color, HIV-positive models, to associate their products with a risque lifestyle and progressive politics. And that's precisely how Obama functioned. And it's why, after he won election, Advertising Age gave him their top annual award, which was Marketer of the Year. He beat Apple, he beat Zappos, he beat Nike, because the professionals understood precisely what he had done. And he has served the interests of the moneyed elite and the corporate state as assiduously as George W. Bush.
But even your former newspaper, the New York Times, has wondered why he was so effective in getting his message across when he was running for office and why he seems so ineffective now.
Well, because he played to that populist undercurrent. I mean, one of the fascinating things about this ridiculous straw poll in Iowa, where people had to pay $30 in order to vote, is that everybody focused on Bachmann without dealing with the fact that Ron Paul came almost beat her and came in second. And I think that there is a populist backlash and a populist rage. And I think that these people have a right to be enraged. What terrifies me is that it has been co-opted by proto-fascist right-wing movements that celebrate the gun culture, homophobia, a hatred of Muslims, a hatred of undocumented workers. And you know, it's that old Yeats line, the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity.
Well, Ron Paul is an odd case because he's really a true libertarian. He's against war or against the wars that we've been engaged in. But on the other hand, even though he seems to appeal to a lot of people who have been disenfranchised, many of the things he calls for would disenfranchise them even further.
Well, I'm not a supporter of Ron Paul. And, you know, in the age of...
But I wonder about that appeal. Do people not hear what politicians are saying when they say, we want to get rid of Social Security, I want to get rid of Medicare, I want to get rid of the Federal Reserve, et cetera, et cetera?
I think that the anger towards government, and of course that anger by the Koch brothers and others has been carefully channeled away from Wall Street towards government, it has, as you point out, a kind of self-destructive quality. And once we roll around to October of this year and unemployment benefits are no longer extended and we see serious slashes among vital social service programs that are keeping many, many people in this country from bankruptcy and even hunger. I mean, 47 million Americans now live in a state of poverty, the reaction will be different. Right now, it's theoretical, and in a few weeks, it won't be.
For one of your columns, you spoke to Lee Allen Jones, last year's Green Party candidate for President Obama's former Senate seat, and he said, among other things, if we prosecute derivatives the same way you prosecute dope, which is not different in how it undermines a family, Wall Street wouldn't exist.
Well, I think
you go along with that?
Yeah, I think that that part of my problem with the traditional media is it pays deference to institutions such as Goldman Sachs, Citibank, that have become in many ways criminal enterprises. We talked about the press. I mean, part of the failure of the New York Times in its one of the most robust business sections of any paper in the country is that it didn't go into neighborhoods where people were being handed subprime mortgages that investment houses like Goldman Sachs knew couldn't be repaid and bet against. And yet the only criminal prosecution we've had is against Bernie Madoff because he stole from rich people.
A listener posted this question on our show page. He writes, while I'm sure Mr. Hedges stands by the comments that caused him to separate from the New York Times, has he ever missed the access his job afforded him, or has he simply shifted his sense of purpose?
No, because all of the reporting that I have done since I began covering the war in El Salvador has been among the poor, many of whom are illiterate, the access played a very small part in the kind of journalism that I carried out or that I was interested in. I mean, I was in Sarajevo during the war, which meant physically being within a besieged city. And I day after day was not running out and interviewing particularly the heads of the Muslim government, but investigating and writing about shelling and killings and atrocities that took part on a daily basis within that war.
The United States has shown support for Egyptian, Libyan, Syrian rebel groups that have fought for more democracy in their countries. How does this change our standing abroad, and how does it affect American foreign policy going forward?
Libya is an open question. I've covered Libya. I've interviewed Gaddafi. I was in the Middle East for 7 years.
Is he as crazy as everybody seems to say he is? Yesterday we spoke to John Burns,
who
made him sound really weird.
He is, but he's also smart. He's crazy and smart. That was what I took away from two interviews, long interviews that I did with him. And that's a pretty dangerous combination. Libya could be a real mess. The tribal factions are intense. A lot of the people running the insurgency worked for years for Gaddafi and are pretty unscrupulous people. And I think one of the undercurrents for those of us who come out of the Middle East is that much of what's driving the unrest is around food prices, commodity prices. Wheat has increased in price by 100% in the last 8 months. Now, when you're living on $2 a day, as half of all Egyptians are, this really means that it's becoming difficult to feed your kids.
So is the problem in this country, as you see it, that we haven't become desperate enough? Because as we've seen around the world, revolution involves tremendous sacrifice and even the possibility that you'll lose your life.
Well, these corporations know only one word, and that's more. and they will press until Americans are desperate enough. Of those 47 million Americans who live in poverty, and of course they're surrounded by tens of millions who live in a category called near poverty, they're spending about 35% of their income now on food. And as we cut social service programs, as long-term employment becomes chronic, one in six is it American workers without a job, real unemployment and underemployment, as the Los Angeles Times is pointing out, somewhere between 17 and 20%, we're not going to be immune from these forces.
And so how do we deal with this corporate stranglehold as you see it?
Well, I think the great moral voices in this country, Bill McKibben, who was just arrested 2 days ago in front of the White House, Wendell Berry.
What did they arrest Bill McKibben for? Saying we should have more greenery?
No, it was to the pipeline being a proposed pipeline from the tar sands down to the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. And it was around that issue. But, of course, Bill has courageously singled out the climate change issue and the fact that our dependence on fossil fuels, if we don't break them, will kill us. Wendell Berry occupied the governor's office. I think that Cornel West and I have been involved in this decision to go down and occupy Washington on October 6th. I think civil disobedience is the last thin line of defense because the structure of power has been so corrupted and is so controlled by corporate interests that what we have undergone is a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion. And the citizenry itself is irrelevant. Nobody wanted the bailouts. Nobody wanted the FISA Reform Act. Nobody wanted Obamacare, which ends up being the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, $400 billion in subsidies. Nobody wants these things. But corporations want them, and so they get pushed through. And I think that if we who care about a civil society and care about democracy don't begin to carry out these acts of civil disobedience, then when everything blows up, and I think there is no, at this point, reason to believe that that's not where we're finally headed, then we will cede control to these forces we spoke about earlier that I find very, very frightening, and of course, at their core, very not only racist and intolerant and of course engaging in the language of violence, which I can tell you as a war correspondent in times of breakdown leads to acts of violence, but you know, really deeply anti-democratic.
But most of the acts of civil disobedience we've seen in this country in recent years have to do with shutting down abortion clinics or protesting
right.
same-sex marriage.
But you hit, Leonard, that's it. I mean, you hit it. And the fact is that we who care about, and of course I'm deeply nonviolent. I mean, nobody who has not been as intimately connected with war as I have can't come away without understanding the poison of violence.
Although you did talk earlier in your career about being addicted to the adrenaline rush.
Yes, I was.
Being in those dangerous situations.
I imbibed the disease, and that's why I know it like a former junkie or an addict so well. And it terrifies me. And violence terrifies me. And I think that we have to carry out militant acts of nonviolence and civil disobedience now, because otherwise we are really flirting with a culture that could descend into real violence.
Chris Hedges, thank you so much for being with us. The book, The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress, published by Nation Books in the Truth Dig imprint. Mr. Hedges writes for Truth Dig and is also a fellow at the Nation Institute. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Leonard.